through those caverns where ghostly shadows dwell, Odysseus had his Tiresias, just as Dante had his Virgil. And in the Metropole Hotel, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov had a 9-year-old girl by the name of Nina Kulikova. For on the first Wednesday in July, as the Count sat in the lobby at a loss of what to do with himself, he happened to notice Nina zipping past with an unusually determined expression. "Hello, my friend. Where are you headed?" Turning about like one who's been caught in the act, Nina composed herself, then answered with a wave of the hand. "Around and about." The Count raised his eyebrows. "And where is that exactly?"
"At this moment, the card room."
"Ah, so you like to play cards?"
"Not really."
"Then why on earth are you going there?" "Oh, come now," the Count protested. "Surely there are not going to be secrets between us." Nina weighed the Count's remark. Then, looking once to her left and once to her right, she confided. She explained that while the card room was rarely used, at 3 o'clock on Wednesdays, 4 women met there without fail for a regular game of whist, and if you arrived by 2:30 and hid in the cupboard, you could hear their every word, which included a good deal of cursing, and when the ladies left, you could eat the rest of their cookies. The Count sat upright. "Where else do you spend your time?" Again she weighed the Count's remark, looked left and looked right.
"Meet me here," she said, "tomorrow at 2.
And thus began the Count's education. Having lived at the Metropole for 4 years, the Count considered himself something of an expert on the hotel. He knew its staff by name, its services by experience, and the decorative styles of its suites by heart. But once Nina had taken him in hand, he realized what a novice he had been. In the 10 months that Nina had lived at the Metropole, she had been confronted with her own version of confinement. For, as her father had been posted only temporarily to Moscow, he had not bothered to enroll her in school. And as Nina's governess still had one foot set firmly in the hinterlands, she preferred that her charge remain on the hotel's premises, where she was less likely to be corrupted by street lamps and trolley cars. So, if the door of the Metropole was known the world over for spinning without stop, it spun not for Nina. But, an enterprising and tireless spirit, the young lady had made the most of her situation by personally investigating the hotel until she knew every room, its purpose, and how it might be put to better use. Yes, the Count had gone to the little window at the back of the lobby to ask for his mail, but had he been to the sorting room where the incoming envelopes were spilled on a table at 10 and at 2, including those that were stamped in red with the unambiguous instruction, "For immediate delivery"? And yes, he had visited Fatima's in the days when it was open, but had he been inside the cutting room? Through a narrow door at the back of her shop was that niche with a light green counter where stems had been snipped and roses dethorned, where even now one could find scattered across the floor the dried petals of 10 perennials essential to the making of potions. "Of course," exclaimed the Count to himself. Within the Metropole there were rooms behind rooms and doors behind doors, the linen closets, the laundries, the pantries, the switchboard. It was like sailing on a steamship. Having enjoyed an afternoon shooting clay pigeons off the starboard bow, a passenger dresses for dinner, dines at the captain's table, outplays the cocky French fellow at baccarat, and then strolls under the stars on the arm of a new acquaintance, all the while congratulating himself that he has made the most of a journey at sea. But in point of fact, he has only exposed himself to a glimpse of life on the ship, having utterly ignored those lower levels that teem with life and make the passage possible. Nina had not contented herself with the views from the upper decks. She had gone below, behind, around, about. In the time that Nina had been in the hotel, the walls had not grown inward. They had grown outward, expanding in scope and intricacy. In her first weeks, the building had grown to encompass the life of 2 city blocks. In her first months, it had grown to encompass half of Moscow. If she lived in the hotel long enough, it would encompass all of Russia. To initiate the Count's course of study, Nina quite sensibly began at the bottom, the basement and its network of corridors and cul-de-sacs. Tugging open a heavy steel door, she led him first into the boiler room, where billows of steam escaped from a concertina of valves. With the aid of the Count's handkerchief, she gingerly opened a small cast-iron door in the furnace to reveal the fire that burned day and night, and which happened to be the best place in the hotel to destroy secret messages and illicit love letters.
"You do receive illicit love letters, Count?"
"Most certainly." Next was the electrical room, where Nina's admonition that the Count touched nothing was quite unnecessary, since the metallic buzzing and sulphurous smell would have counseled caution to the most reckless of adventurers. There, on the back wall, amidst a confusion of wires, Nina showed him the very lever that, when pulled, could throw the ballroom into darkness, providing perfect cover for the snatching of pearls. After a turn to the left and 2 to the right, they came to a small cluttered room, a sort of cabinet of curiosities, showcasing all the items that the hotel's guests had left behind, such as umbrellas, Baedekers, and the weighty novels they had yet to finish but could no longer bear to lug about. While tucked away in the corner, looking no worse for wear, were 2 small oriental rugs, a standing lamp, and the small satinwood bookcase that the Count had abandoned in his old suite. At the far end of the basement, as the Count and Nina approached the narrow back stair, they passed a bright blue door.
"What do we have here?" asked the Count.
Nina looked uncharacteristically flummoxed.
"I don't think I've been inside."
The Count tried the knob. "Ah, well, I'm afraid that it's locked." But Nina looked left and looked right. The Count followed suit. Then she raised her hands under her hair and unhooked the delicate chain that she wore around her neck. Dangling at the bottom of the golden parabola was the pendant the Count had first observed at the piazza, but it was neither a lucky charm nor locket. It was a passkey for the hotel. Nina slid the key from its chain and handed it to the Count so that he could do the honours. Slipping it through the skull-shaped hole in the escutcheon, the Count turned gently and listened as the tumblers fell into place with a satisfying click. Then he opened the door, and Nina gasped, for inside there was a treasure trove, quite literally. On shelves that lined the walls from floor to ceiling was the hotel's silver service, shimmering as if it had been polished that very morning.
"What is it all for?"
she asked in amazement.
"For banquets," replied the Count.
Alongside the stacks of Sèvres plates bearing the hotel's insignia were samovars that stood 2 feet tall and soup tureens that looked like the goblets of the gods. There were coffee pots and gravy boats. There was an assortment of utensils, each of which had been designed with the greatest care to serve a single culinary purpose. From among them, Nina picked up what looked like a delicate spade with a plunger and an ivory handle. Depressing the lever, Nina watched as the 2 opposing blades opened and shut. Then she looked to the Count in wonder.
"An asparagus server," he explained.
"Does a banquet really need an asparagus server?"
"Does an orchestra need a bassoon?"
As Nina returned it gently to the shelf, the Count wondered how many times he had been served by that implement. How many times had he eaten off these plates? The bicentennial of St. Petersburg had been celebrated in the Metropole's ballroom, as had the centennial of Pushkin's birth and the annual dinner of the Backgammon Club. And then there were the more intimate gatherings that took place in the 2 private dining rooms adjacent to the Boyarsky, the yellow and red rooms. In their heyday, these retreats were so conducive to frank expressions of sentiment that if one were to eavesdrop at their tables for a month, one would be able to anticipate all of the bankruptcies, weddings, and wars of the year to come. The Count let his eyes wander over the shelves, then shook his head to express a sense of mystification. Surely the Bolsheviks have discovered this windfall. I wonder why it wasn't carted off. Nina responded with the unclouded judgment of a child. Perhaps they need it here. Yes, thought the Count, that is it precisely. For however decisive the Bolsheviks' victory had been over the privileged classes on behalf of the proletariat, they would be having banquets soon enough. Perhaps there would not be as many as there had been under the Romanovs. No autumn dances or diamond jubilees, but they were bound to celebrate something, whether the centennial of Das Kapital or the silver anniversary of Lenin's beard. Guest lists would be drawn up and shortened. Invitations would be engraved and delivered. Then, having gathered around a grand circle of tables, the new statesmen would nod their heads in order to indicate to a waiter, without interrupting the long-winded fellow on his feet, that, yes, they would have a few more spears of asparagus. For pomp is a tenacious force, and a wily one too. How humbly it bows its head as the emperor is dragged down the steps and tossed in the street. But then, having quietly bided its time, while helping the newly appointed leader on with his jacket, it compliments his appearance and suggests the wearing of a medal or two. Or, having served him at a formal dinner, it wonders aloud if a taller chair might not have been more fitting for a man with such responsibilities. The soldiers of the common man may toss the banners of the old regime on the victory pyre, but soon enough trumpets will blare and pomp will take its place at the side of the throne, having once again secured its dominion over history and kings. Nina was running her fingers over the various serving implements with a blend of admiration and awe. Then she came to a stop. What is that? On the shelf behind a candelabra stood a 3-inch-tall woman, fashioned from silver with the hoop skirt and towering hair of a Marie Antoinette. It's a summoner, said the Count.
A summoner?
To be placed on the table beside the hostess. The Count picked up the little lady by her bouffante, and when he waggled her to and fro, out from under her skirt came that delightful jangle at a high C that had prompted the end of 1,000 courses and the clearing of 50,000 plates. In the days that followed, Nina presented her curriculum systematically, leading her student from room to room. At the onset, the Count had assumed that all their classes would be held on the hotel's lower levels, where its services were housed. But having visited the basement, the mailroom, the switchboard, and all the other nooks of the first floor, one afternoon they proceeded up the staircase to the suites. Now, admittedly, the exploration of private apartments represents something of a break with decorum, but Nina's interest in visiting the rooms was not thievery, nor was it snooping per se. It was the views. Each of the rooms of the Metropole offered an entirely different perspective, one that was shaped not only by altitude and orientation, but by season and time of day. Thus, if by chance one cared to watch the battalions marching toward Red Square on the 7th of November, one should go no further than room 322. But when one wished to drop snowballs on unsuspecting strollers, this was best accomplished from the deep-ledged windows of 405. Even room 244, a rather depressing little spot overlooking the alley behind the hotel, had its allure, for from there, if one leaned far enough out of the window, one could watch the fruit sellers gather at the kitchen door and catch the occasional apple tossed from below. But if one wished to watch the arrival of guests at the Bolshoi on a summer night, the best vantage point, without question, was the northwest window of 317. And so, on the 12th of July at 7 o'clock, as the Count was crossing the lobby, Nina caught his eye and gave him the signal. 2 minutes later, Having joined her on the stairs, he was trailing her past rooms 313, 314, and 315 toward the door of his old suite. And when Nina turned the key and slipped inside, the Count dutifully followed, but with a palpable sense of foreboding. In a glance, the Count reacquainted himself with every inch of the room. The couch and chairs upholstered in red remained, as did the grandfather clock and the large Chinese urns from idle hour. On the French coffee table, that had been supplied to replace his grandmother's, was a folded copy of Pravda, a silver service, and an unfinished cup of tea. "Quick," she said again, as she padded across the room to the window at the northwest corner. Across Theatre Square, the Bolshoi was lit from portico to pediment. The Bolsheviks, who, as usual, were dressed like the cast of La Bohème, were taking advantage of the warm night air by mingling among the columns. Suddenly, the lights in the lobby flickered. Scuffing out their cigarettes, the men took their ladies by the elbow. But just as the last of the attendees was disappearing through the doors, a taxi pulled to the curb. The door flung open, and a woman in red dashed up the stairs with the hem of her dress in her hands. Leaning forward, Nina cupped her palms against the glass and squinted. "If only I were there and she were here," she sighed. And there, thought the Count, was a suitable plaint for all mankind. Later that night, as he sat alone on his bed, the Count mulled over his visit to his old suite. What had stayed with him was not the sight of his family's clock still ticking by the door, nor the grandeur of the architecture, nor even the view from the northwest window. What had lingered with him was the sight of the tea service on the table beside the folded paper. That little tableau, for all its innocence, was somehow suggestive of exactly what had been bearing down on the Count's soul. For he understood every aspect of the scene at a glance. Having returned from some outing at 4 o'clock, and having hung his jacket on the back of a chair, the room's current resident had called for tea and an afternoon edition. Then he had settled himself down on the couch to while away a civilized hour before it was time to dress for dinner. In other words, what the Count had observed in Suite 317 was not simply an afternoon tea, but a moment in the daily life of a gentleman at liberty. In light of these thoughts, the Count reviewed his new room, the 100 square feet that had been assigned to him. Never had it seemed so small. The bed crowded the coffee table. The coffee table crowded the high-backed chair, and the high-backed chair had to be shoved aside every time one wished to open the closet. Simply put, there was not enough space to accommodate such a civilized hour. But as the Count gazed around him with this forlorn thought, a voice only half his own reminded him that in the metropole there were rooms behind rooms and doors behind doors. Rising from his bed, the Count navigated his way around his grandmother's coffee table, set aside the high-back chair, and stood before his telephone box of a closet. Running along the perimeter of where the closet met the wall was an elegant oak moulding. The Count had always thought this flourish a little excessive, but what if the closet had been built in an old door frame? Opening the door, the Count parted his clothes and tentatively rapped on the back wall. The sound was promisingly thin. With three fingers, he gave the barrier a push and could feel it flex. He took all his jackets out and dumped them on the bed. Then, holding the jambs of the door, he kicked the inner wall with his heel. There came a pleasant crack. Leaning back, he kicked again and again until the barrier splintered. Then he pulled the jagged planks back into his room and slipped through the gap. He was now inside a dark, narrow space that smelled of dry cedar, presumably the interior of the neighbouring closet. Taking a breath, he turned the knob, opened the door, and entered a room that was the mirror image of his own, but in which 5 unused bed frames had been stored. At some point, 2 of the frames, which had been leaning against the wall, had fallen, pinning the hallway door shut. Pulling the frames aside, the Count opened the door, dragged everything out of the room, and began to refurnish. First, he reunited the 2 high-back chairs with his grandmother's coffee table. Then, taking the belfry stairs, he went down to the basement. From the cabinet of curiosities, he retrieved one of his rugs, the standing lamp, and the small bookcase in 3 separate trips. Then, vaulting the steps 2 at a time, he made 1 final visit in order to claim 10 of the weighty novels that had been abandoned. Once his new study was furnished, he went down the hall and borrowed the roofer's hammer and 5 nails. The Count had not wielded a hammer since he was a boy at idle hour, when he would help Tikhon, the old caretaker, repair the fencing in the first weeks of spring. What a fine feeling it had been to bring the hammer down squarely on the head of a nail, driving it through a plank into a fence post as the impact echoed in the morning air. But on the very first stroke of this hammer, what the Count squarely hit was the back of his thumb. Lest you have forgotten, it is quite excruciating to hammer the back of your thumb. It inevitably prompts a hopping up and down, and the taking of the Lord's name in vain. But fortune does favour the bold, so, while the next swing of the hammer glanced off the nail's head, on the 3rd the Count hit home, and by the 2nd nail he had recovered the rhythm of set, drive, and sink. That ancient cadence which is not to be found in quadrilles or hexameters or in Vronsky's saddlebags. Suffice it to say that within 30 minutes, 4 of the nails had been driven through the edge of the door into the door frame, such that from that moment forward the only access to the Count's new room would be through the sleeves of his jackets. The 5th nail he saved for the wall above the bookcase, so that he could hang the portrait of his sister. His work completed, the Count sat down in one of the high-back chairs and felt an almost surprising sense of bliss. The Count's bedroom and this improvised study had identical dimensions, and yet they exerted a completely different influence on his mood. To some degree, this difference stemmed from the manner in which the 2 rooms had been furnished, for while the room next door, with its bed, bureau, and desk, remained a realm of practical necessities, the study, with its books, the ambassador, and Helena's portrait, had been furnished in a manner more essential to the spirit. But in all likelihood, a greater factor in the difference between the 2 rooms was their provenance. For if a room that exists under the governance, authority, and intent of others seems smaller than it is, then a room that exists in secret can, regardless of its dimensions, seem as vast as one cares to imagine. Rising from his chair, the Count took up the largest of the 10 volumes that he had retrieved from the basement. True, it would not be a new venture for him. But need it be? Could one possibly accuse him of nostalgia or idleness, of wasting his time simply because he had read the story 2 or 3 times before? Sitting back down, the Count put 1 foot on the edge of the coffee table and tilted back until his chair was balanced on its 2 hind legs. Then he turned to the opening sentence. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Marvellous, said the Count. An assembly.
Oh, come along.
I'd rather not.
Don't be such a fuddy-duddy.
I am not a fuddy-duddy.
Can you be so sure?
A man can never be entirely sure that he is not a fuddy-duddy. That is axiomatic to the term.
Exactly.
In this manner, Nina coerced the Count to join her on one of her favourite excursions, spying from the balcony of the ballroom. The Count was reluctant to accompany Nina on this particular journey for 2 reasons. First, The ballroom's balcony was narrow and dusty, and to stay out of sight one was forced to remain hunched behind the balustrade, a decidedly uncomfortable position for a grown man over 6 feet tall. The last time the Count had accompanied Nina to the balcony, he had torn the seam of his pants, and it took 3 days for him to lose the crick in his neck. But second, this afternoon's gathering was almost certain to be another assembly. Over the course of the summer, the assemblies had been occurring at the hotel with increasing frequency. At various times of day, small groups of men would come barreling through the lobby, already gesticulating, interrupting, and eager to make their points. In the ballroom, they would join their brethren milling shoulder to shoulder, every other one of them puffing on a cigarette. As best as the Count could determine, the Bolsheviks assembled whenever possible, in whichever form, for whatever reason. In a single week, there might be committees, caucuses, colloquiums, congresses, and conventions variously coming together to establish codes, set courses of action, levy complaints, and generally clamour about the world's oldest problems in its newest nomenclature. If the Count was reluctant to observe these gatherings, it was not because he found the ideological leanings of the attendees distasteful. He would no sooner have crouched behind a balustrade to watch Cicero debating Catiline, or Hamlet debating himself. No, it was not a matter of ideology. Simply put, the Count found political discourse of any persuasion to be tedious. But then, wasn't that exactly what a fuddy-duddy would argue? Needless to say, the Count followed Nina up the stairs to the second floor. Having skirted the entrance to the Boyarsky and ensured the coast was clear, they used Nina's key to open the unmarked door to the balcony. Down below, 100 men were already in their chairs, and another 100 were conferring in the aisles, as 3 impressive fellows took their seats behind a long wooden table on the dais. Which is to say, the assembly had nearly assembled. As this was the 2nd of August, and there had already been 2 assemblies earlier that day, the temperature in the ballroom was 91 degrees. Nina skirted out behind the balustrade on her hands and knees. When the Count bent over to do the same, the seam in the back of his pants gave way again. "Mad," he muttered. "Shh," said Nina. The first time the Count had joined Nina on the balcony, he couldn't help but feel some astonishment at how profoundly the life of the ballroom had changed. Not 10 years before, all of Moscow society would have been gathered in their finery under the grand chandeliers to dance the mazurka and toast the Tsar. But after witnessing a few of the assemblies, the Count had come to an even more astonishing conclusion. That despite the revolution, the room had barely changed at all. At that very moment, for example, 2 young men were coming through the doors looking game for the fray. But before exchanging a word with a soul, they crossed the room in order to pay their respects to an old man seated by the wall. Presumably, this elder had taken part in the 1905 revolution, or penned a pamphlet in 1880, or dined with Karl Marx back in 1852. Whatever his claim to eminence, the old revolutionary acknowledged the deference of the 2 young Bolsheviks with a self-assured nod of the head, all the while sitting in the very chair from which the Grand Duchess Anna Pova had received the greetings of dutiful young princes at her annual Easter ball. Or consider the charming-looking chap who, in the manner of Prince Tetrakov, was now touring the room, shaking hands and patting backs. Having systematically made an impression in every corner, with a weighty remark here and a witty remark there, he now excused himself for just a moment. But once through the door, he will not reappear. For having ensured that everyone in the ballroom has noted his attendance, he will now head off to an altogether different sort of assembly, one that is to take place in a cozy little room in the Abad. Later, no doubt, some dashing young Turk who is rumoured to have Lenin's ear will make a point of arriving when the business of the evening is nearly done, just as Captain Rodchenko had when he had the ear of the Tsar, thus exhibiting his indifference to the smaller conventions of etiquette, while reinforcing his reputation as a man with so much to attend to and so little time to attend to it. Of course, there is now more canvas than cashmere in the room, more grey than gold. But is the patch on the elbow really that much different from the epaulette on the shoulder? Aren't those workaday caps donned, like the bicorn and shako before them, in order to strike a particular note? Or take that bureaucrat on the dais with his gavel. Surely he could afford a tailored jacket and a creased pair of pants. If he is wearing this ragged fare, it is in order to assure all assembled that he, too, is a hardened member of the working class. As if hearing the Count's thoughts, this secretary suddenly rapped his gavel on the tabletop, calling to order the second meeting of the First Congress of the Moscow branch of the All-Russian Union of Railway Workers. The doors were closed. Seats were taken. Nina held her breath. And the assembly was underway. In the first 15 minutes, 6 different administrative matters were raised and dispensed with in quick succession, leading one to imagine that this particular assembly might actually be concluded before one's back gave out. But next on the docket was a subject that proved more contentious. It was a proposal to amend the union's charter, or more precisely, the 7th sentence of the 2nd paragraph, which the secretary now read in full. Here, indeed, was a formidable sentence, one that was on intimate terms with a comma and that held the period in healthy disregard. For its apparent purpose was to catalogue without fear or hesitation every single virtue of the union, including but not limited to its unwavering shoulders, its undaunted steps, the clanging of its hammers in summer, the shovelling of its coal in winter, and the hopeful sound of its whistles in the night. But in the concluding phrases of this impressive sentence, at the very culmination, as it were, was the observation that through their tireless efforts, the railway workers of Russia facilitate communication and trade across the provinces. After all the build-up, it was a bit of an anticlimax, conceded the Count. But the objection being raised was not due to the phrase's overall lack of verve. Rather, it was due to the word facilitate. Specifically, the verb had been accused of being so tepid and prim that it failed to do justice to the labours of the men in the room. "We're not helping a lady put on her jacket," someone shouted from the rear. "Or painting her nails. Hear, hear." Well, fair enough. But what verb would better express the work of the union? What verb would do justice to the sweaty devotion of the engineers, the unflagging vigilance of the brakemen, and the rippling muscles of those who laid the tracks? A flurry of proposals came from the floor. To spur, to propel, to empower. The merits and limitations of each of these alternatives were hotly debated. There were 3-pointed arguments counted out on fingertips, rhetorical questions, emotional summations, and back-row catcalls punctuated by the banging of the gavel, as the ambient temperature of the balcony rose to 96 degrees. Then, just as the Count began to sense some risk of riot, a suggestion came from a shy-looking lad in the 10th row that perhaps, to facilitate, could be replaced with to enable and ensure. This pairing, the lad explained, while his cheeks grew red as a raspberry, might encompass not only the laying of rails and the manning of engines, but the ongoing maintenance of the system.
Yes, that's it. Laying, manning, and maintenance. To enable and ensure.
With hearty applause from every corner, the lad's proposal seemed to be barreling toward adoption as quickly and dependably as one of the union's locomotives barrels across the step. But just as it was nearing its terminus, a rather scrawny fellow in the 2nd row stood. Such a wisp of a man was he that one wondered how he had secured a position in the union in the first place. Once he had the attention of the room, this back-office clerk or accountant this all-Russian pusher of pencils, asserted in a voice as tepid and prim as the word facilitate.
Poetic concision demands the avoidance of a pair of words when a single word will suffice.
What's that?
What did he say?
Several stood up with the intention of grabbing him by the collar and dragging him from the room. But before they could get their hands on him, a burly fellow in the fifth row spoke without rising to his feet.
With all due respect to poetic concision, the male of the species was endowed with a pair when a single might have sufficed.
Thunderous applause. The resolution to replace facilitate with enable and ensure was adopted by a unanimous show of hands and a universal stomping of feet. While in the balcony, a private acknowledgement was made that perhaps political discourse wasn't always so dull after all. At the conclusion of the assembly, when the Count and Nina had crawled off the balcony and back into the hallway, the Count felt quite pleased with himself. He felt pleased with his little parallels between the respect payers, backpatters, and latecomers of the present and those of the past. He also had a whole host of entertaining alternatives to the phrase enable and ensure, ranging from bustle and trundle to currum and careen. And when Nina inevitably asked what he thought of the day's debate, he was going to reply that it was positively Shakespearean. Shakespearean, that is, in the manner of Dogberry in Much Ado About Nothing. Much Ado About Nothing, indeed. Or so the Count intended to quip. But by a stroke of luck, he didn't get the chance. For when Nina asked what he thought of the assembly, unable to wait even a moment for his impressions, she barreled ahead with her own.
Wasn't that fascinating? Wasn't it fantastic? Have you ever been on a train?
The train is my preferred means of travel, said the Count, somewhat startled. She nodded enthusiastically.
Mine as well. And when you have travelled by train, have you watched the landscape rolling past the windows and listened to the conversations of your fellow passengers and drifted off to the clacking of the wheels?
I have done all of those things.
Exactly. But have you ever, for even one moment, considered how the coal finds its way into the locomotive's engine? Have you considered, in the middle of a forest or on a rocky slope, how the tracks came to be there in the first place?
The Count paused, considered, imagined, admitted.
Never.
She gave him a knowing look.
Isn't it astounding?
And when seen in that light, who could disagree? A few minutes later, the Count was knocking on the office door of Marina, the shy delight, while holding a folded newspaper at the back of his pants. Not long ago, the Count recalled, there had been three seamstresses at work in this room, each before an American-made sewing machine. Like the three fates, together they had spun and measured and cut, taking in gowns, raising hems, and letting out pants with all of the fateful implications of their predecessors. In the aftermath of the revolution, all three had been discharged. The silent sewing machines had, presumably, become the property of the people. And the room? It had been idled like Fatima's flower shop. For those had not been years for the taking in of gowns or the raising of hems any more than they had been for the throwing of bouquets or the sporting of boutonnieres. Then, in 1921, confronted with a backlog of fraying sheets, tattered curtains, and torn napkins, which no one had any intention of replacing, the hotel had promoted Marina, and once again a trustworthy seam was being sewn within the walls of the hotel.
"Ah, Marina," said the Count when she opened the door with needle and thread in hand. "How good to find you stitching away in the stitching room."
Marina looked at the Count with a touch of suspicion.
"What else would I be doing?"
"Quite so," said the Count. Then, offering his most endearing smile, he turned 90 degrees, briefly lifted the newspaper, and humbly asked for her assistance.
"Didn't I repair a pair of your pants just last week?"
I was spying with Nina again, he explained, from the balcony of the ballroom. The seamstress looked at the Count, with one eye expressing consternation and the other disbelief.
If you're going to clamber about with a 9-year-old girl, then why do you insist upon wearing pants like those?
The Count was a little taken aback by the seamstress's tone.
When I dressed this morning, it was not my plan to go clambering about. But either way, I'll have you know that these pants were custom-made on Savile Row.
Yes, custom-made for sitting in a sitting room or drawing in a drawing room.
But I have never drawn in a drawing room.
Which is just as well, since you probably would have spilled the ink.
As Marina seemed neither particularly shy nor delightful that day, the Count offered her the bow of one who would now be on his way.
Oh, enough of that, she said. Behind the screen and off with your pants.
Without another word, the Count went behind the dressing screen, stripped to his shorts, and handed Marina his pants. From the ensuing silence, he could tell that she had found her spool, licked her thread, and was carefully directing it through the eye of the needle.
Well, she said, you might as well tell me what you were doing up in the balcony.
So, as Marina began stitching the Count's pants, the laying of locomotive tracks, writ small, if you will, he described the assembly and all his various impressions. Then, almost wistfully, he noted that even as he was seeing the intractability of social conventions and the human tendency to take itself too seriously, Nina was becoming enthralled by the assembly's energy and its sense of purpose.
And what is wrong with that?
Nothing, I suppose, admitted the Count. It's just that only a few weeks ago she was inviting me to tea in order to ask about the rules of being a princess.
Handing the Count's pants back over the screen, Marina shook her head like one who must now deliver a hard truth to an innocent of mind.
All little girls outgrow their interest in princesses, she said. In fact, they outgrow their interest in princesses faster than little boys outgrow their interest in clambering about.
When the Count left Marina's office with a thanks, a wave, and the seat of his pants intact, he practically fell over one of the bellhops, who happened to be standing outside the door.
Excuse me, Count Rostov.
That's quite all right, Petya. No need to apologize. It was my fault, I'm sure.
The poor lad, who looked positively wide-eyed, hadn't even noticed that he'd lost his cap. So, picking it up from the floor and placing it back on the bellhop's head, the Count wished him godspeed in his business and turned to go.
But my business is with you.
With me?
It is Mr. Halecki. He wishes to have a word in his office.
No wonder the lad was wide-eyed. Not only had the Count never been summoned by Mr. Halecki, in the 4 years that he had been in residence in the metropole, he had not seen the manager on more than 5 occasions. For Joseph Halecki was one of those rare executives who had mastered the secret of delegation. That is, having assigned the oversight of the hotel's various functions to capable lieutenants, he made himself scarce. Arriving at the hotel at 8:30, he would head straight to his office with a harried expression, as if he were already late for a meeting. Along the way, he would return greetings with an abbreviated nod, and when he passed his secretary, he would inform her, while still in motion, that he was not to be disturbed. Then he would disappear behind his door. And what happened once he was inside his office? It was hard to tell, since so few had ever seen it, although those who had caught a glimpse reported that his desk was impressively free of papers, his telephone rarely rang, and along the wall was a burgundy chaise with cushions that were deeply impressed. When the manager's lieutenants had no choice but to knock, due to a fire in the kitchen or a dispute about a bill, the manager would open his door with an expression of such fatigue, such disappointment, such moral defeat, that the interrupters would inevitably feel a surge of sympathy, assure him that they could see to the matter themselves, then apologetically back out the door. As a result, the Metropole ran as flawlessly as any hotel in Europe. Needless to say, The Count was both anxious and intrigued by the manager's sudden desire to see him. Without further ado, Petya led him down the hall, through the hotel's back offices, and finally to the manager's door, which predictably was closed. Expecting Petya to formally announce him, the Count paused a few feet short of the office, but the bellhop made a sheepish gesture toward the door and then vanished. With no clear alternative, the Count knocked. There followed a brief rustling, a moment of silence, and a beleaguered call to come in. When the Count opened the door, he found Mr. Halecki seated at his desk with a pen firmly in hand, but without a piece of paper in sight. And though the Count was not one to draw conclusions, he did note that the manager's hair was matted on one side of his head, and his reading glasses were crooked on his nose.
"You wish to see me?"
"Ah, Count Rostov, please, come in."
As the Count approached one of the two empty chairs that faced the desk, he noted that hanging above the burgundy chaise was a lovely series of hand-tinted engravings depicting hunting scenes in the English style.
"Those are excellent specimens," said the Count as he took his seat.
"What's that? Oh, yes, the prints. Quite excellent, yes."
But having said this, the manager removed his glasses and ran a hand over his eyes. Then he shook his head and sighed. And as he did so, the Count felt a welling of that famed sympathy.
"How can I be of service to you?" asked the Count, on the edge of his seat.
The manager gave a nod of familiarity, having presumably heard this question a thousand times before, then put both hands on his desk.
"Count Rostov," he began, "you have been a guest of this hotel for many years. In fact, I gather your first visit here dates back to the days of my predecessor."
"That's right," the Count confirmed with a smile. "It was in August 1913.
"Quite so. A room 215, I believe." "Ah, a delightful room."
The two men were silent.
"It has been brought to my attention," the manager continued, if somewhat haltingly, "that various members of the staff, when speaking to you, have continued to make use of certain honorifics."
"Honorifics?"
"Yes. More precisely, I gather they have been addressing you as Your Excellency."
The Count considered the manager's assertion for a moment.
"Well, yes. I suppose that some of your staff address me in that fashion."
The manager nodded his head, then smiled a little sadly.
"I'm sure you can see the position that this puts me in."
In point of fact, the Count could not see the position that this put the manager in, but given the Count's unmitigated feelings of sympathy, he decidedly did not want to put him in any position. So he listened attentively as Mr. Halecki went on.
"If it were up to me, of course, it goes without saying. But what with..."
Here, just when the manager might have pinpointed the most specific of causes, he instead gave an indefinite twirl of the hand and let his voice drift off. Then he cleared his throat.
"Naturally, I have little choice but to insist that my staff refrain from using such terms when addressing you. After all, I think we can agree without exaggeration or fear of contradiction that the times have changed."
In concluding thus, the manager looked to the Count so hopefully that the Count took immediate pains to reassure him.
"It is the business of the times to change, Mr. Halecki, and it is the business of gentlemen to change with them."
The manager looked to the Count with an expression of profound gratitude. That someone should understand what he had said so perfectly, no further explication was required. There was a knock at the door, and it opened to reveal Arkady, the hotel's desk captain. The manager's shoulders slumped at the sight of him. He gestured toward the Count.
"As you can see, Arkady, I am in the midst of a conversation with one of our guests."
"My apologies, Mr. Halecki, Count Rostov."
Arkady bowed to both men, but did not retreat.
"All right, then," said the manager. "What is it?" Accardi gave a slight gesture of the head to suggest that what he had to relate might best be related in private.
Very well.
Pushing himself up with both hands, the manager shuffled past his desk, out into the hall, and closed the door, such that the Count found himself alone.
Your Excellency,
the Count reflected philosophically.
Your Eminence, Your Holiness, Your Highness.
Once upon a time, the use of such terms was a reliable indication that one was in a civilized country. But now, what with... Here, the Count gave an indefinite twirl of the hand.
Well, it is probably for the best, he said.
Then, rising from his chair, he approached the engravings, which upon closer inspection depicted three phases of a fox hunt: the scent, tally-ho, and the chase. In the second print, a young man in stiff black boots and a bright red jacket was blowing on a brass horn that turned a full 360 degrees from its mouthpiece to its bell. Without a doubt, the horn was a carefully crafted object, expressive of beauty and tradition. But was it essential to the modern world? For that matter, did we really need a crew of nattily dressed men, purebred horses, and well-trained dogs to corner a fox in a hole? Without exaggeration or fear of contradiction, the Count could answer his own question in the negative. For the times do, in fact, change. They change relentlessly, inevitably, inventively. And as they change, they set into bright relief not only outmoded honorifics and hunting horns, but silver summoners and mother-of-pearl opera glasses, and all manner of carefully crafted things that have outlived their usefulness. Carefully crafted things that have outlived their usefulness, thought the Count. I wonder. Moving quietly across the room, the Count put an ear to the door, where he could hear the voices of the manager, Arcadi, and a third party talking outside. Though muted, their tones suggested they were still a few steps from resolution. Quickly, the Count returned to the wall with the etchings and counted two panels beyond the depiction of the chase. Placing his hand in the center of the panel, he gave a firm push. The panel depressed slightly. When a click sounded, the Count pulled back his fingers and the panel popped open, revealing a hidden cabinet. Inside, just as the Grand Duke had described, was an inlaid box with brass fittings. Reaching into the cabinet, the Count gently lifted the lid of the box, and there they were, perfectly crafted and peacefully at rest. Marvellous, he said. Simply marvellous.
Archaeologies.
Pick a card,
the Count was saying to the smallest of the three ballerinas. When he had entered the Chaliapin for his reinstated nightly aperitif, the Count had discovered them standing in a row, their delicate fingers resting on the bar as if they intended to plié. But for a solitary drinker hunched over his consolation, the young ladies were alone in the bar, so it seemed only appropriate that the Count should join them in a bit of conversation. In an instant, he could tell that they were new to Moscow, three of the doves that Gorsky recruited from the provinces every September to join the corps de ballet. Their short torsos and long limbs were of the classical style preferred by the director, but their expressions had yet to acquire the aloofness of his more seasoned ballerinas. And the very fact that they were drinking at the Metropole unaccompanied hinted at a youthful naivete. For while the proximity of the hotel to the Bolshoi made it a natural choice for young ballerinas who wished to slip away at the end of rehearsal, the same proximity also made it a favoured spot of Gorsky's whenever he wished to discuss matters of art with his prima ballerina. And should these doves be discovered by the director sipping muscat, they would soon be doing the pas de deux in Petropavlovsk. With that in mind, perhaps the Count should have warned them. But freedom of the will has been a well-established tenet of moral philosophy since the time of the Greeks, and though the Count's days of romancing were behind him, it goes against the nature of even the well-meaning gentleman to recommend that lovely young ladies leave his company
on the basis of hypotheses.
So, instead, the Count remarked on the young lady's beauty, inquired what brought them to Moscow, congratulated them on their achievements, insisted upon paying for their wine, chatted with them about their hometowns, and eventually offered to perform a sleight of hand. A deck of cards with the Metropole's insignia was produced by the ever-attentive Odrius.
"It has been years since I have done this trick," the Count admitted, "so you must bear with me." As he began to shuffle the pack, the three ballerinas watched him closely, but like demigods of ancient myth, they watched in three different ways, the first through the eyes of the innocent, the second through the eyes of the romantic, and the third through the eyes of the skeptic. It was the dove with the innocent eyes whom the Count had asked to pick a card. As the ballerina was making her selection, the Count became aware of someone standing behind his shoulder, but this was to be expected. In the setting of a bar, a sleight of hand will inevitably attract a curious onlooker or two. But when he turned to his left to offer a wink, he found not a curious onlooker, but unflappable Arkady, looking unusually flapped.
"Pardon me, Count Rostov. I'm sorry to interrupt, but may I have a moment?"
"Certainly, Arkady." Smiling apologetically to the ballerinas, the desk captain led the Count a few paces away, then let the facts of the evening speak for themselves. At 6:30, a gentleman had knocked at the suite of Secretary Tarakovsky. When the esteemed secretary opened the door, this gentleman demanded to know who he was and what he was doing there. Taken aback, Comrade Tarakovsky explained that he was the current resident of the suite, and that was what he was doing there. Unconvinced by this logic, the gentleman insisted he be admitted at once. When Comrade Tarakovsky refused, the gentleman brushed him aside, crossed the threshold, and commenced searching the rooms one by one, including, ahem, the salle de bain, where Mrs. Tarakovsky was seen to her nightly toilette. This was the point at which Arkady had arrived on the scene, having been summoned urgently by phone. In an agitated state, Comrade Tarakovsky waved his cane and demanded, as a regular guest of the Metropole and senior member of the party, to see the manager at once. The gentleman, who was now sitting on the couch with his arms crossed, replied that this suited him perfectly, as he had been about to summon the manager himself. And as to party membership, he asserted that he had been a member of the party since before Comrade Tarakovsky was born, which seemed a rather incredible claim, given that Comrade Tarakovsky is 82. Now, the Count, who had listened with interest to every word that Arkady had related, would be the first to admit that this was an enthralling tale. In fact, it was just the sort of colourful incident that an international hotel should aspire to have as part of its lore, and that he, as a guest of the hotel, would be likely to retell at the first opportunity. But what he could not understand was why Arkady had chosen this particular moment to share this particular story with him.
"Why? Because Comrade Tarakovsky is staying in Suite 317, and it is you for whom the gentleman in question was looking."
"Me?"
"I am afraid so."
"What is his name?"
"He refused to say."
"Then where is he now?"
Arkady pointed toward the lobby.
"He is wearing out the carpet behind the potted palms."
"Wearing out the carpet?"
The Count stuck his head out of the chalupin as Arkady leaned cautiously behind him. And sure enough, there on the other side of the lobby was the gentleman in question, making quick business of the 10 feet between the pair of plants. The Count smiled. Though a few pounds heavier, Mikhail Fyodorovich Mindich had the same ragged beard and restless pace that he had had when they were 22.
"Do you know him?"
asked the desk captain.
"Only like a brother."
When the Count and Mikhail Fyodorovich first met at the Imperial University in St. Petersburg in the fall of 1907, the two were tigers of a very different stripe. While the Count had been raised in a 20-room mansion with a staff of 14, Mikhail had been raised in a two-room apartment with his mother. And while the Count was known in all the salons of the capital as one who could be counted on for his wit, intelligence,